This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Meghna Chakrabarty is out today. In the news this week, Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley brings the legal hammer down on some of the nation's biggest banks. She filed suit against them yesterday for a variety of alleged offenses related to the mortgage foreclosure crisis.
They believe they're too big to care about the impact of their actions. And we believe they are not too big to have to obey the law.
Also this week, Barney Frank says enough. After more than three decades in Congress, one of the nation's most outspoken, articulate, and pugnacious liberals says he won't run again.
One of the advantages to me of not running for office is I don't even have to pretend to try to be nice to people I don't like.
We're going to miss him. And with a little more than a month to go before New Hampshire's first in the nation primary, businessman Herman Cain stumbles badly over allegations of sexual infidelity. Mitt Romney remains the front runner, but the new buzz is suddenly all about former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Just ask him.
I think at a time when we're hurting financially, we're hurting in jobs, we're hurting in the deficit, having somebody who is a serious developer of better solutions all of a sudden kind of gelled.
Those are some of the stories our Week in Review panel are going to take on this afternoon. And joining me in the studio right now, Boston Globe columnist Scott Lehi. Thanks for coming in, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is reporter Kyle Chaney with the State House News Service. Welcome back, Kyle. Happy Friday to you.
Good to be here.
So let's start with the big news that broke late yesterday. Attorney General Martha Coakley filed suit against several banks, including Bank of America, Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan, Chase & Company, and GMAC. The suit accuses them of a variety of offenses, including illegally seizing properties, filing fraudulent foreclosure documents, and not doing enough to help struggling borrowers stay in their homes. Now, the background to this, Coakley was part of a group of state attorneys general trying to negotiate a settlement with the banks, but she says the negotiations have stalled, so she's taking them to court.
They've had more than a year to show they've understood their role and the need to show their accountability for this economic mess, and they failed to do so.
Scott Lehi, let's start with you. What's your take on this story?
Well, I think that part of it is straight up there, that they don't feel that the banks have really negotiated in good faith. And I think that in the AG's office, the idea is here, okay, we will move outside the process, outside the negotiation, build a strong case, and then these guys will either have a much greater impetus to reach a settlement and a new kind of code of behavior, or we'll go to court on the thing. And I also think there's a little bit of an aspect of, inside, outside, good prosecutor, bad prosecutor, good cop, bad cop thing going on here, where she is going to put some outside pressure, and that may catalyze more action inside the negotiating group. But clearly, the AG's office does not think that over 14 months they've seen the requisite movement and acknowledgement from the mortgage folks here, the banks, that they want to see.
So I'm interested in this idea of good cop, bad cop, mm-hmm. Kyle, because meanwhile, the talks between the attorneys general and the banks are continuing. Mm-hmm. But this sort of the Coakley lawsuit sort of, I don't know, it kind of puts her on a big platform in here as well.
It does. It's a huge high-stakes gambit someone in her office must have had to sit there and say, all right, we're going to sue. I wonder who the first person to suggest suing Bank of America was. To reach that point, it's just loaded with political ramifications and practical ramifications for, as we just learned, I think, as we came in here, that GMAC is going to stop offering loans in Massachusetts going forward. So there's some practical implications, too, and it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out.
Yeah, and that story you just mentioned is really significant. GMAC just announced, this is right before we went on air, that it's going to leave Massachusetts, stop providing loans. That's significant because it's coming at a time when loans are harder and harder to get. Right, Scott?
I think it looks to me like, it's become a battle, kind of a brinksmanship thing here, and who's going to blink? But obviously, whenever you move a mortgager out of a market, it makes things a little tougher. But I would be surprised. They must have anticipated that in the AG's office, and I would be surprised if that precipitates any sort of backdown on this. I think that this is one of those things. You cross the Rubicon, and you you have to move forward on it. I would think. Wouldn't you, Kyle?
Yeah, well, and it comes at a time when I think there's a lot of political angst out there against major financial institutions. You've got this sort of Occupy Wall Street situation going on in the background, so might make it a little give some political cover for a move like this for the Attorney General to make. But the banks and the institutions have ways of making the state feel pain and consumers feel pain could give Coakley second thoughts later on.
Well, some serious allegations in here. For their part, the banks say they're disappointed with the suit and that the negotiations were moving forward. Here's a brief piece of a statement from Chase, which says that the settlement talks could bring immediate relief to Massachusetts borrowers rather than years of contested legal proceedings. So I'm wondering, is there any risk that Coakley's lawsuit could further slow down these talks? What do you think, Scott?
I don't really think years of legal proceedings is the correct frame on this. I think that that's the kind of thing you hear people say in an oppositional, sort of position, but I don't really see why this would take long years to try a case like this. So I think that's more bluff, honestly. Mm.
What do you think, Kyle? Bluff?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think years of litigation sounds scary and sounds like maybe more trouble than it's worth. And I think that's sort of, as Scott said, fits in line with being sort of oppositional. So I don't know if that's realistic or not.
Well, fascinating story, and we'll keep tabs on it. Let's move on to the big political story this week, which was Barney Frank. After 3 decades in Congress, the Massachusetts congressman announced that he won't run for re-election next year. He cited several reasons, chief among them a much-changed political culture across the country and in Washington.
The leverage you have within the government has substantially diminished. The anger in the country, the currents of opinion are such so that the kind of inside work I have felt best at is not going to be as productive for the foreseeable future, and not until we make some changes.
Scott Lehigh, he talked a lot about that issue with us when we spoke to him earlier this week. He also talked about the way his district was redrawn, which makes it a little more conservative, a little less reliably liberal. What did you take away from his announcement in terms of the real reasons that he stepped down? Or that he's not planning to rerun, I should say.
I think the district was a lot of it. Now, it is true that in Congress, Congressman Frank has always had quite a good relationship with people on the other side that wanted to do serious business. And I know that when he was the ranking minority member on financial services, he had a very good relationship with the chairman and vice versa. I think so. I think he has been able to work in a bipartisan fashion. Interestingly, some years back, he was chosen both as one of the most partisan members of Congress and one of the most bipartisan members of Congress. You know, so he kind of a guy who fights the fights, but behind the scenes wants to get things done. So I think probably with the new Republican takeover, it is true that it's much harder to do things. But I think the district is what really did it for him. I think he really liked representing New Bedford. He had a very strange district, but now his district, I think he thought he was going to get more Metro West, which would be easy for him, places where people know him. Now he's been pushed over into kind of a circuitous route through the Blackstone Valley, which is more conservative territory. And, you get to be his age. You don't really want to be out there running around
right,
the state.
71
meeting
years
new
old.
People.
He's been doing it for a while. And that's pretty much what he said to us. One of the things he said was, look, I'd have to go out, meet a whole bunch of new constituents. I'm only going to go for one more term anyway. So I'd basically have to say, look, elect me. I'll do my best. And then I'm not going to be here in two years.
So I kind of take him at his word there. What I thought was funny was, said, I don't even have to pretend to be nice to people that I don't like. I didn't think he was making that pretense. I mean, I think a lot of people who've kind of felt the sting of Barney's anger thought, well, this guy just, he doesn't cut you any slack if he doesn't like you.
Not one to mince words.
But evidently he thought he was being nice.
Yeah. Kyle, talk a little bit about his legacy. I mean, I guess it's the Dodd-Frank financial overhaul bill had a lot to do with the way he will be remembered. I mean, what are we going to miss about Barney Frank?
Absolutely. Well, there's a lot we're going to miss about Barney Frank, although in some respects we may not miss it that much. He made pretty clear he intends to stay in full public view regardless of what his new next role is going to be, so we'll see if that pans out. But no question that Dodd-Frank is his legacy, their move to sort of reshape the financial order after the meltdown of 2008-2009. And he said he planned to stay in Congress in part to protect that legacy. I think he said recently there was almost nothing he would change about it, and that is certainly going to come under attack whether he stays or not. And so I think to him it's important to at least do what he can now to preserve that.
Kyle, you're up there on Beacon Hill. I'm curious to know how you responded to his sort of critique of the redistricting process. He was much more sort of expansive on this mm-hmm. with the Boston Globe mm-hmm. than he was with us. But, you know, he complained that the redistricting process hurt his district more than, example, it did Congressman Ed Markey's district, who he said had a lot of influence and managed to help himself, Ed Markey, mm-hmm. but not Frank.
It sounds a little bit like sour grapes, and I only say that because when you look at how the redistricting process went, everyone started with these low expectations and things were going to, you know, be disastrous like they had been in previous cycles. At the end of the day, everyone seemed pretty satisfied with the way every district was redrawn, congressional and statewide districts. And so this is really the first hint of someone was dissatisfied with the way the process went. And, you know, every district underwent changes. The chairman of the redistricting committee, Mike Moran, in the House, the state House, you know, said everyone saw some significant changes. You've got Democratic Party leaders who noted that Barney Frank's district, even with the changes, is still one of the more Democratic districts in the state. So when you hear Barney Frank get out there and say, you know, it would have been, I think it's more about having to go out to campaign to new voters than it is that it made it more conservative.
But I do think he thought he was going to get more of Metro West, places
right,
where
right,
he's known right. and it would be a little easier to campaign in. And, of course, Markey has, I think, a relationship mm-hmm. with the speaker. And when you get to a redistricting year, there may be a lot of cohesion in a delegation, but when a redistricting year comes up, it really is every man for himself.
Sure.
And because these guys are all, it's musical chairs here,
right.
and they're all trying to make sure that they've got a seat. So I think that you know, I think he has a gripe, but the fact of the matter is that what should drive redistricting? In the old days, they would get together with Tip and the legislative leaders, and they would say, okay, what do you guys want? And the delegation would sort of work it out themselves. That's changed. These guys did, as Kyle said, really quite a good job of making geographically coherent districts. And Barney's isn't completely that way, but it was, you know, frankly, not so bad. But most of the rest are quite good. But when you do something like that and you straighten out as gerrymandered a map as we have, mm-hmm. it naturally means there's going to be a lot of change in districts that incumbents had come to had gotten quite used to.
Well, in terms of what comes next for Frank mm-hmm. and his district, here's mm-hmm. Congressman Michael Capuano.
I know Barney well enough to know that he will not remain silent, and that's a good thing. But I also know Barney well enough to know that he would hope that whoever replaces him is an effective advocate for his constituents.
So Barney won't remain silent. That's a given. But Kyle, what do we know about who might replace him?
Well, we don't know much, to be honest. What we do know is that there's dozens and dozens of names that have been floated out there already. I think in some ways there's more of a clamoring to define the field now. Everyone's anxious to see who's going to get in it. That's actually outpacing the rate at which people want to declare their intentions to run. The couple of known candidates, Elizabeth Child, I believe her name is.
That's right, Elizabeth Childs of Brookline.
On the Republican side.
On the Republican side, that's right.
And a number of candidates have declared their interest. I think District Attorney Sam Sutter is one.
Mark Pacheco's mm-hmm. talking, taunting the senator a little bit mm-hmm. about it.
Mm-hmm. And Cindy Cream. And you've got a bunch of population centers like Taunton, like Brookline and Newton that can produce a significant number of candidates, and so it's really up in the air.
The latest of the Joe Kennedys is mm-hmm. supposedly
taking a look.
That's
what I was going to say. Yeah. Joseph B. Kennedy III, yeah. He's the son of the former congressman, yeah. A federal prosecutor down on the Cape, right, and highly regarded among
not
Democratic,
a federal, a state prosecutor.
State prosecutor, regarded by the sort of state Democratic establishment, mm-hmm. I gather.
Well, you mean, yeah. I mean, I'm not sure he's
whatever
highly regarded as a prosecutor, but he's a, you know, what you mean to say is he's a Kennedy. I guess that's right, yeah. I think the question there will be, how far did the apple fall from the tree? Mm-hmm. And as someone who thinks his father's a bit of a knucklehead, the further the apple fell from the tree, I think the better it is for his candidacy, probably. But he seems, I mean, I don't really know him very well, but I'm told he's not a bad kid. But, mm-hmm. but you know, he's 30, 31. Does he really deserve a congressional seat? Probably. Mm-hmm. Other than the fact his name is Kennedy, probably not, really.
And he opened some eyes at the State House. He gave a speech in the House chamber, was that a year ago, I think. And, you know, very, very political, at a time when the tension in politics hasn't really abated, but it was at a real fever pitch. And he gave an interesting speech about just decrying the tension and the gridlock mm-hmm. in Washington, and it opened people's eyes. So,
well, it's an interesting transition. I'm going to miss Barney Frank. I'm not expressing any kind of political bias here. I'm going to miss his brains, his zeal for political combat, which was always entertaining to watch.
You know what's
and
interesting
to?
About yeah. about Barney is we've lost now. I mean, in the last couple of years, Ted Kennedy and Barney Frank, he's not gone yet, obviously, yeah. but two people that were the big national voices, and it's not clear we have anyone else in our delegation who fills that role, really.
Really interesting. Well, let's stick with politics, but move north to New Hampshire and assess what's happening with just a little more than a month to go before the New Hampshire primary. The big development this week involves the campaign of Herman Cain, allegations of sexual harassment, and now this week, new allegations of a longstanding extramarital affair, which he has denied. Here he is facing the media yesterday in New Hampshire.
If your opposition is determined to bring you down, they will stop at nothing. I have worked with thousands of people. I can't possibly say that someone won't trump up another accusation. It just goes with the territory.
Now, Herman Cain is at home today, apparently talking to his wife. He says he's going to be making a major announcement tomorrow about the future of his candidacy to clarify. Those are his words. Scott Lehi, does it look like clarification here means the end?
Well, his campaign really, I mean, it's ended one way or the other, I think. And I would imagine he would jump out. He's reconsidering the campaign. Who knows? The wife may be reconsidering the marriage. Pretty obviously.
That's got to be a rough conversation
something,
at home.
There's something going on here. And you can't continually say when people come forward and say, oh, this isn't his opposition trying to destroy him. I mean, it's a woman that looks like he had a relationship with, and he looks like he's lying about it. So I think that even if he doesn't get out, the Herman Cain boomlet is over.
Kyle, the Herman Cain boomlet over. One of the Republicans amidst a small group who seemed to sort of have their moment. I mean, there was Michelle Bachmann. There was Rick Perry before him. Now Cain flaming out, right?
It feels like deja vu. I feel like I think I've been on here a couple of times, and as the different iterations of these allegations came up. And so it's actually amazing he's been able to continually be in sort of that top tier as long as he did amid the allegations. This does seem like sort of the nail in the coffin. But you know what? Some of these candidates have come back from worse, and it just depends on what voters in a primary season are willing to forgive and what kind of, if he can make a convincing case. You know, I could very much see a scenario where he comes out tomorrow and says, my clarification is I'm staying in this to win it. Maybe far-fetched, but it's not completely out of the question.
Well, we'll know tomorrow soon enough. So left standing, of course, is Mitt Romney in a big way. He's still the front runner, but here comes former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who's polling well in states like Florida. What does he add to the race, Scott Lehi? How worried should Mitt Romney be?
Well, if the question that's being asked here is who can beat Barack Obama, the answer is not Newt Gingrich.
Right.
But if the question is who expresses maybe the pugnacity and the desired conservatism, I mean, maybe the answer is that. I find it hard to believe that given Newt's history, that the party would really nominate him. It does seem to me that's a concession that you're not going to win the elections. But that said, I mean, this is not a party that has reconciled itself to Mitt. So I think, personally, my view is the only two people who could beat Obama among the Republican field, John Huntsman and Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
So I think
that's right.
I can't imagine that Newt has got such a checkered past, and he's just, he's like a truckload of nitroglycerin, trying to make it over a mountain pass. But you know, it's possible they nominate him. I personally don't see it. The next stage of the campaign you're clearly going to see is as Mitt turns to Newt and decides how he is going to take him on, and we'll see whether he can take him down. There certainly are ample targets of opportunity when it comes to Newt Gingrich. He is part of the sort of cronyistic, capitalistic culture in Washington that he decries. What he's told us about his role at Freddie Mac obviously isn't really very true. They weren't looking for his views as his historian. He's taken a lot of liberties with the truth. And he's this kind of vitriolic personality that I think typifies what people really don't like about the Washington culture. So I'm kind of surprised by it. But I don't think he... I can't imagine him as a serious general election candidate.
Vitriol has actually been valued somewhat this year during the Republican primaries. In a sense, it seems in some ways like some of the harsher and angrier rhetoric has actually generated the most positive response in some cases.
It's true. It's a season where anti means a lot. If you're anti something or pro anger, I guess that seems to really be carrying a lot of stock. I'm sort of curious about this, and it has to do with the peculiar dynamic of the New Hampshire primary. I mean, as we know, finishing first isn't necessarily winning in New Hampshire. In other words, you know, this is Mitt Romney's race to lose in New Hampshire. So let's assume he wins. But there's Gingrich with a really credible second place finish. Mm-hmm. He can sort of say, hey, this is Mitt Romney's backyard. This is a victory.
Absolutely. Know? It's all about placement there. It's all about who's got momentum, who's moving. You know, like as you said, if Mitt Romney finishes, just squeaks out a win, that's bad news for his campaign. You know, I think they have to be in Romney headquarters banging their head against the wall that you know they keep clearing the field supposedly of these boomlets of that from some of the candidates, and yet here comes somebody else surging. I don't know what they have to do to sort of become the clear and decisive front runner.
Hmm. Newt, I think, has already declared he's the nominee, more or less. He said on it was ABC that I am the nominee.
At some point, you have to wonder if Romney can continue to say he's the front runner. There was a national Rasmussen poll that showed Gingrich, I think, crushing Romney nationally, which doesn't mean much in terms of the primary states, but that's still, he can make a case that he's the front runner.
But it's also true that Romney has organization. He has had more money. I mean, he's got a whole infrastructure mm-hmm. in place. Right now, unexamined in a way, Gingrich has momentum, but momentum often sort of dissipates on the shoals of lack of organization, I think.
Well, it's interesting. Romney still looking to sort of, ignite that huge bit of enthusiasm, but there is this sort of sense that he's sort of going slow, going calm. I think he's going to emerge as the candidate. We'll see. Anyway, let's move on to our weekly hubbub, that story that didn't get much play or notice. Maybe it should have. Kyle, let me start with you, your hubbub.
I don't know if you guys followed this, but the legislature and the governor decided they wanted to move next year's primary election from September 18th to September 6th, mainly to avoid a conflict with Rosh Hashanah. Turns out, though, that nobody, as they vetted this bill for weeks, thought to look at the Democratic National Convention calendar and to realize that September 6th is also the day that President Obama is supposed to accept the nomination and give a big speech in Charlotte, and many Massachusetts Democrats would probably want to be there.
A little bit of a conflict.
Big conflict for some of them. I think, who knows if Governor Patrick's going to get a speaking slot or even Elizabeth Warren. Probably going to be a new effort to change that date, but it's already sparking some political backlash at home.
Interesting how calendars always feature so prominently in political season. Scott Lehigh, your hubbub.
I think Don Berwick, who's been the temporary appointment at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, steps down two days ago, because he could not get Senate confirmation. Highly acclaimed Harvard professor, public health pediatrician, really an expert in this field, but he's the second Massachusetts academic, the other being Peter Diamond at MIT, who was nominated for the Federal Reserve, who could not get even a vote in the Senate because of filibuster threat.
Interesting. Well, here's mine really quickly. The end of a tradition at Tufts, no more naked quad run. In fact, what they're doing is sort of the overdressed quad stroll. So a bit of an end of a tradition. I'm not sure what it says about our society, but there it is. Stay with us. Up next, changing the way Muslim Americans are viewed in Boston. That's the goal of a new Muslim cultural center, which opens its doors today on Newbury Street. Scott Lehigh, Boston Globe columnist, thanks so much. We appreciate you coming in. And Kyle Chaney, reporter for the State House News Service, thank you very much for coming in. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.